Good morning. This is the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is designed for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Bob Martin. We're here again reading from this week's Independent, dated Wednesday, May 15th, 2019. We begin with the news section. Homecoming. Almost 750 prisoners were released to Durham last year. A new city program seeks to ease their transition. For 7 years, Calvin White's family helped to support him while he was in prison, putting money in his commissary account, paying for phone calls, and visiting him as often as they could. When he got out, just before Christmas, he wanted to return the help. "You want to be able to pay your bills," he said. "You want to support yourself. You want to support the ones that looked out for you while you were gone. You don't want them taking care of you while you were gone and then get out and they're still taking care of you. I was ready, like, I need a job. I need a job." White, 38, had been preparing for his release, scouring newspapers to see what jobs were in demand, and earning every certification he could, even if it meant being transferred to another prison farther from his family in Durham. After about 10 transfers, taking him as far as coastal Craven County, he had credentials in HVAC, culinary arts, and brick masonry. He took business classes. He was ready. "I was thinking, if I come home, I got these credentials. Even though I know the felony is on my record, I should be able to find a job like that," he said, snapping his fingers. But it was completely different. Opposite. He applied for so many jobs he lost count. He'd get excited about a prospect only to have the interview eventually come back to his record. It's not that he wasn't willing to address it. He took responsibility for his manslaughter conviction and for changing his life in the intervening years. The problem was what would follow, usually some vague response like, "Well, we'll call you." They never called. But thanks to a reentry program, the city of Durham has recently expanded to serve people coming home from every prison in North Carolina. That's changed. Last month, White started a job doing HVAC and other work for the city's General Services Department. Through the Welcome Home program, which launched in October, White got peer support to help him navigate the transition after prison. He was also connected to the city's transitional jobs program, through which he got job training at Durham Tech. Before starting at General Services, the city is trying to bring private employers on board as well. The program is part of a larger effort by the city's innovation team to reduce economic barriers for justice-involved Durham residents. Last year, 743 Durham residents were released from North Carolina prisons. Welcome Home seeks to connect them to housing, employment, transportation, and advice so that they can successfully reintegrate into a community that they sometimes left years ago, and then to avoid further contact with the criminal legal system. Each participant, 48 so far, gets a box of items, usually donated and packed by church groups, to help them make the transition. A bus pass, toiletries, groceries, a cell phone, and a letter signed by Mayor Steve Shule welcoming them and telling them that they are not alone. In addition, they get 20 hours of peer support from a specialist who is formerly incarcerated, although relationships between participants and specialists last far beyond those 20 hours. Peer support is a tried-and-true aspect of reentry programs across the country. Through these programs are often targeted at specific populations, such as people with mental illness or substance addictions. What sets Welcome Home apart is its wraparound, hands-on nature. Peer support specialists take participants shopping for a job interview outfit. They connect them to other city and affiliated initiatives, like the Transitional Jobs Program and a License Restoration and Expunction Clinic. They call halfway homes looking for beds for those who don't have a place to go. Chuck Manning Sr., a program creator and one of the three specialists, says nothing like Welcome Home existed when he was released in 2015 from the Durham jail after 14 months. He estimates that he applied for 80 jobs, but he struggled to get hired because of his record. You're on an emotional roller coaster. You're happy to be free and to be home, but that you know you have a responsibility to take care of your family. He knew how to cook, so he borrowed a grill and put $145 he had saved up towards starting a catering business. He didn't have a driver's license, so he hitched that grill to a cousin's truck. Through that, he got connected to Bull City United, an anti-violence program, then to the city's innovation team, and realized the motivational scriptures he used to hand out to other detainees in the jail were actually the beginning of a career helping others whose shoes he'd been in. But Manning says he wouldn't be where he is today if he hadn't found mentors who succeeded in making the same transition. In addition to the hurdles returning prisoners face finding jobs and housing, many don't have licenses because of unresolved tickets, don't have bank accounts, and don't have experience with technology that became ubiquitous while they were locked up. It's hard to know where to start, and easy to fall back on the behavior that got them behind bars, Manning said. When your head is spinning like that, that's when you tend to make some bad decisions. According to the North Carolina Sentencing and Policy Advisory Commission, of the 15,000 people released from state prisons in 2015, 31% had been rearrested a year later. Of those arrests, a quarter happened within the person's first 3 months out of prison, underscoring the importance of early intervention. Research suggests that employment, housing, and peer support can all reduce recidivism. Welcome Home aims to reach prisoners 60 days before their release to start generating both trust and a post-release game plan. The program started out serving four prisons in the region, but with the help of Durham's local reentry council, it's reaching into all 56 prisons in the state, as well as the federal complex in Butner. It's a simple process. The LRC provides the program with a list of Durham residents with an upcoming release date. The Welcome Home team writes each a letter. Welcome Home has sent letters to 130 people who are set to be released by the end of June, and asks them to write back if they're interested in participating. Manning has also built relationships with parole officers in order to reach people who are already out of jail that the program missed. From there, participants can pick up their box of items at City Hall and get assigned a peer support specialist who offers advice, rides, and networking help, and even trips to Walmart or Target to buy an outfit for job interviews using a gift card provided through the program. For Letitia Bright, getting that letter from Manning made her feel like someone was looking out for her. I got home at Christmas, and I couldn't wait for Monday to come just so I could hear Chuck's voice, says Bright, the mother of six, who spent 5.5 months at the North Carolina Correctional Institution for Women. Manning's support also helped her when she needed to quickly change her address, a typically mundane process that, when you're on parole, can lead to the state to believe you skipped town if it's not done correctly. Prior to her release, Bright's home plan entailed staying home with her mom. The prison officials didn't approve it because her mother lives in a Durham Housing Authority unit, and the DHA can, and sometimes must, deny people admission for past criminal activity. So she moved in with her sister, whose lease was ending in 3 days. That meant Bright not only had to move out on short notice, but reach her parole officer during the holidays and register a new address before going anywhere. If she didn't get permission in time, she'd be marked absconded. Bright frantically called her parole officer, and Manning started looking for a backup in case her sister's new place wasn't approved. In the end, Bright got approval to move in with her mom, but the prospect of going back to prison for no good reason frightened her. Since then, Welcome Home has helped Bright get unpaid traffic tickets waived and her driver's license reinstated. She's also planning on getting her GED. Bright got a break a lot of former prisoners don't. Her sister helped her line up a job doing housekeeping at a hotel. Almost all large employers conduct criminal background checks on applicants, according to the Second Chance Alliance, a statewide organization dedicated to addressing the causes and consequences of criminal records. A Northwestern University study found that applicants with records are 50% less likely to get a call back. The prospects are even worse for black applicants. According to the North Carolina Sentencing and Policy Advisory Commission, 53% of people who left the state's prison in 2015 were unemployed 2 years later. In addition, just 26% had graduated high school, and 78% had a possible substance use problem. People who were unemployed, unmarried, didn't finish high school, or used drugs were more likely to reoffend. Out of the 48 people served so far by Welcome Home, Manning says all but three have remained arrest-free. Research suggests that over time, up to 4 years for drug or property crime offenders, according to a study in 2009, American Society of Criminology Journal, people with prior convictions become no more likely to commit a crime than the general public. For Manning, those second chances can be transformative. One thing you lose in mass incarceration is the school-to-prison pipeline. You lose a voice and a power for yourself, he said. This program gives you back your power. Our next news article, Leap of Faith-Based Funding. Raleigh gave $30,000 to a clinic that partners with anti-abortion and pro-LGBTQ conversion organizations. The Raleigh City Council unanimously voted to give $30,000 to a faith-based health clinic last week, though several council members later said they were unaware that the clinic lists as partners an anti-abortion rights organization and a church that promotes conversion therapy for LGBTQ people. Some council members say they regret the decision, though others point out that the clinic provides vital health care services to low-income refugees and immigrants. At last Tuesday's council meeting, Kay Crowder asked the council Tuesday to give $30,000 from the city's contingency fund to Neighbor Health, a nonprofit clinic founded in 2018 in Northwest Raleigh. According to the clinic's website, its mission is to serve Christ by loving our neighbors through the practice of excellent, compassionate, and accessible health care. Neighbor Health's website lists among its partners Gateway Pregnancy Center, an anti-abortion rights nonprofit on Hillsborough Street, whose website warns women about the alleged physical, psychological, emotional, and spiritual consequences of abortion, and asks patients to consider, how does God see your unborn child? Neighbor Health also lists as a partner the Church of the Apostles, a Raleigh ministry that invites congregants to connect with the program Beyond Imagination, which aims to bring God's healing and redemptive power to those who struggle with undesired homosexuality. So-called conversion therapy has been banned for minors in several states, and is strongly opposed by the American Psychiatric Association, which calls the practice that it creates a significant risk of harm. Crowder said at the council meeting that Neighborhood Health takes care of an underserved community, including those without insurance. The group was late to the city's grant application process, she explained, so she wanted to give them leftover funds from the contingency fund. Crowder told the Indy Thursday that she'll be unavailable the rest of this week with Mother's Day family obligations. Crowder could not be reached on Monday. Neighbor Health CEO Sue Ellen Thompson says the clinic has seen 1,700 patients since it opened last year, 70% of whom are not insured. For the uninsured, care is provided on an income-based sliding scale, but that money doesn't fully cover the clinic's expenses, so it has to rely on donations and government funding to make up the difference. Reproductive care accounts for less than 10% of the clinic's services, Thompson said. Ask about the clinic's approach to abortion and conversion therapy, Thompson says. Neighbor Health is not political. It does not refer patients to Gateway or give that center money, she said. Instead, Gateway refers patients to Neighbor Health. Thompson told the Indy that the clinic does provide information on abortion, but she adds, it would not promote abortion. We're not going to tell women that they should get an abortion, but they have their right to choose, and we're seeing them from a medical perspective. Doug Briggs, the clinic's head physician, says that he practiced medicine in China for over two decades, where he saw women who were forced to have abortions and then given the aborted fetuses in a plastic bag. While he tells patients that abortion is an option, he said, generally, I would encourage them to keep their baby. He also tells them about the unmeasurable consequence of abortion, which he says include psychological suffering, trauma, grief, suicidal thoughts, and spiritual issues. There are a lot of women who have had abortions who are suffering psychologically, he said, so he also provides post-abortion counseling. Studies claiming that women experience negative mental health effects following an abortion have been critically refuted, according to the Journal of the American Medical Association. Research has found that women who have had abortions do not experience more depression or anxiety than those who carry their pregnancies to term. Neighbor Health hasn't dealt with abortion a lot, at least not yet. Briggs said he's only consulted with one patient who was pregnant and undecided on whether to have the baby. He never consulted with her again, but he believes she was leaning toward carrying the pregnancy to term. Ask about Neighbor Health's association with the Church of the Apostles, Thompson says her brother was gay and died of AIDS in 1992. We are in no way homophobic, she said. Council members Steph Mendel, Corey Branch, and Nicole Stewart say they were unaware of Neighbor Health's connections when they voted to fund the clinic. Mendel says that while the vote was a mistake, she thinks the clinic should keep the money because it provides affordable health care for uninsured patients, including immigrants. Brandt says he's looking into the matter. I'm probably leaning towards reversing it, he said, but I need to have an in-depth conversation with Councillor Crowder. This isn't the first time the city has funded faith-based organizations. It's given $737,000 to Catholic Charities since 2007, and has spent $3.1 million on Oak City Cares, a homeless outreach center on which the Catholic Diocese is partnered. Our next news article, The Chains of Love. A Durham woman says a state prison won't let her marry her fiancé because they're gay. On Monday, an attorney representing an inmate in Neuse Correctional Institution in Gouldsboro sent a letter to the prison superintendent and the NC Department of Justice threatening to sue if she was not permitted to marry her fiancé by June 13th. According to the letter sent by Elizabeth Simpson of the Durham-based Carolina Justice Policy Center, Sandy Dowell was informed earlier this month that the prison's head chaplain did not want to approve the marriage request because it was same-sex and had never been done in North Carolina prisons before. The State Department of Public Safety did not confirm by press time whether a state prison has approved a same-sex wedding since gay marriage became legal in North Carolina in 2014. Noosa's CI's guidelines for Marriage West require couples to attend 4 premarital sessions with an ordained minister and to obtain the approval of the superintendent and the assistant superintendent of the programs. 6 guests can attend. No cameras are permitted. After the ceremony, the newlyweds are allowed a 15-minute visit. The guidelines also specify that the entire processing time for a marriage at the prison may take up to 4 months. We started in November. Here it is May. We have yet to be approved, says Amanda Mariner, Dowell's fiancée, a former prisoner who lives in Durham. It's just being passed around. It's like we've been patient. On November 26th, according to the letter, Mariner and Dowell both wrote to Superintendent Morris Reed asking for permission to marry. Reed never responded. Nor did he respond to repeated follow-ups in writing, voice messages, and when Dowell spoke to him on prison grounds. Then on May 4th, the letter said, Dowell was told that the prison wanted nothing to do with a same-sex wedding. An official at New CI said Monday that he was not authorized to comment. The DPS did not respond to a request for comment on the demand letter by press time. Dowell and Mariner have been together since March 10th of 2003. They were housed in the same dorm in the North Carolina Correction Institution for Women, both serving lengthy times for second-degree murder. Dowell had been sentenced for life for the 1992 killing of a roommate with whom she was romantically involved. Mariner was serving 16 years for the 1999 shooting death of her live-in boyfriend. In 2015, Mariner was released. After that, she said, Dowell grew distant. She'd previously had a longtime prison girlfriend before who'd gotten out and left her. Eventually, Mariner said, they broke up. But after a year apart, they reconnected last June. I said, that year of silence, you're the only person I want to live with. By October, Mariner was back on Dowell's visitors list. By November, they were engaged. They're getting married for love, Mariner says, but also to get practical benefits. As Dowell's wife, Mariner will get to attend her next parole hearing in 2021, which, as an ex-offender, she wouldn't otherwise be able to do. If Dowell is paroled, Mariner can be part of her home plan, again, something she wouldn't likely be able to do otherwise. And as long as Dowell is in prison, Mariner will be able to call and get medical information if she gets sick or has to go to the hospital. Dowell has COPD. Mariner believes prison officials are dragging their feet about the wedding because of homophobia and because they don't want to be trendsetters. The state is in the process of converting New CI to a men's prison, Mariner said, which means Dowell will eventually get moved. So if the prison drags things out long enough, Mariner suggests, the superintendent of the next facility will be the one responsible for approving the prison system's first same-sex wedding. Both Sandy and Amanda want to print prison after heartbreaking relationships, Simpson said. It is a testament to their resilience that they have learned to trust and love again. They deserve to get married, and it is their constitutional right to do so. Now, this week's feature article. This gross old cat has more followers than you. Raleigh loves Tucker. Tucker doesn't love anything. Tucker wears a permanent scowl. His green eyes radiate annoyance. The 22-year-old 25-pound cat doesn't like the baby stroller in which he rides around downtown Raleigh. He likes it even less when he has to haul his fat butt around the Capitol grounds in pursuit of strategically sprinkled treats. He really doesn't like basking in the hot April sun or when excited children squeal and approach with huge smiles. And he certainly doesn't like you. Tucker doesn't enjoy anything, says Tucker's human assistant, Ron Kirk, as he pushes the portly pussycat in a stroller down Fayetteville Street. He just has varying degrees of dislike. Tucker is an old cat, centenarian in people years, so you can ignore his grumpiness. You don't even roll your eyes at the fact that he's being pushed in a stroller. But to look at him, all greels and dandruff-ridden and generally gross, you wouldn't imagine that Tucker had parlayed his almost daily lunchtime patrols of DTR into something approaching celebrity status. But he has, or more accurately, Kirk has. Their About Oak City Kitty Instagram account has more than 7,000 followers, and Tucker has better name recognition downtown than most local politicians. In the span of a few blocks, I watch him encounter and mostly tolerate more than a dozen adoring fans. "Is that Tucker?" asks one, leaning over the stroller to stroke Tucker's head. "Hey, buddy, you having a night day?" Tucker is not. Before we continue, let's get this sort of out of the way. I'm not a cat hater. Quite the opposite, I'm a cat lover. I have two of my own. I'm also the type to spend too much time trolling the internet for cat pics. So, despite Tucker's general disinterest toward humanity, I too am preternaturally inclined toward fawning over him, just like everyone else on Fayetteville Street, it seems. The question is, why? Well, put another way, what is it about this formidable feline that elicits such happiness among strangers when they see him wobbling down the street? And why do pictures of Tucker lying on a treadmill or yawning in front of the History Museum make us obsess over our phones, laughing and commenting and sharing them with friends? Is it that we're so cooped up in our own cubicles, plagued by the perpetual Mondays, that even the slightest break from drudgery can bring circus-sized joy to our hearts? Sort of. To put it more scientifically, says Duke University professor Nagar Mahada, the answer is, Tucker is a walking, breathing mem. Mems are expressive of our emotions, says the professor, who teaches a course on mems, on online objects molded by those who share them. They express an iconography, things that language can't always convey. You have expressed how you feel through an object, and that object then is passed on to someone else who does something else with it. Animals make especially popular memes because they hit close to home. For cat lovers, cat pics are like cheeseburger to a starving man. They trigger a rush of instant gratification. We're so addicted to essentially what is a morphine drip of cats and dogs online, but there are thousands of pet accountants online. What makes Tucker stand out? He's not a kitten, after all. He's probably not what you'd consider adorable. He doesn't do particularly cute things. So why has he become a mem? Now, that's harder to pin down. The professor says, viral sensations are hard to predict and share few similarities. Online success depends in part on the will of the algorithm gods. It can also be a matter of luck, an influencer spreading the word. Tucker's evolution into memdom didn't happen overnight. Kirk met him in 2005 when Tucker, then a sprightly 8-year-old, was a resident at the Orange County Animal Shelter. He likely would have been euthanized were it not for his utility. The staff used him to test out dogs for their compatibility with other animals. If you can get along with Tucker, you can get along with anyone, I suppose. Kirk came to the shelter looking for kitty kinship. Following a bad breakup, there were all kinds of usual candidates, young, cute, small, friendly. But Tucker was different. For whatever reasons, that appealed to Kirk. He was a terrible cat when I first got him. Mean, aggressive, I thought somehow, I got the worst cat in the world. The way to Tucker's heart, Kirk found, was through his stomach. With lots of caloric incentives, that is, treats, Tucker's nastiness began to melt away. But Tucker also began to pack on weight. By 2015, Tucker had ballooned to 32 pounds, which, according to the Association for Pet Obesity Prevention, is a cat equivalent of a morbidly obese 544-pound man. But that doesn't tell the whole story. Tucker is half Maine Coon, the largest breed in domesticated cat. So he's supposed to be big, just not that big. A vet prescribed exercise, a foreign concept to a committed couch potato like Tucker. So Kirk introduced Tucker to the sidewalk outside his combo, next to Sono Sushi. Tucker promptly waddled past the door. The next day, Kirk placed him 3 feet out, and to the door, Tucker returned. Soon, Tucker became comfortable lounging about 10 feet away on the sidewalk, and eventually, with some treat motivation, he began to follow Kirk up and down the block, his belly swaying back and forth like a pendulum, nearly brushing the pavement. Passersby began to take notice. Some mistook Tucker for a feral raccoon. Others asked Cat Kirk, who was never big on social media, if Kirk was on Instagram. Kirk figured it might be a fun waste of time. In April 2016, Tucker premiered on Instagram, posing coyly in front of the Capitol with the hashtag FatCat. The post got fewer than a dozen likes, mostly from Kirk's family. Within a year, though, Tucker had amassed 1,000 followers, both from word of mouth and people who'd encountered him, IRL. His popularity really blossomed in late 2017 when Kirk forced Tucker into a Santa outfit. It was at that point, Kirk says, that Tucker found his voice, which is, of course, Kirk's voice, although Kirk insists it's Tucker's voice, and expresses profound displeasure in the costume and the caption. "No, this is unacceptable, completely unacceptable. I did not agree to this, nor do I give you permission to post this picture," Tucker's rant begins. "Do not share with friends. Remove it at once. Why do you continue to take pictures after I have presented you with my demands, human? Why are you laughing? Why is it still on my head? I hope you go shopping and get trampled. It would bring me joy." "Tucker writes everything, I proofread," Kurt resists. "If this seems weird, remember that Kurt is a guy who pushes his cat in a stroller down Fayetteville Street. Having a view of a ticked-off, overweight cat is a little more interesting than, here's Tucker's walking down the stairs. Note, Tucker hates stairs. Tucker's sarcasm and irreverence, borrowed bordering on nihilism, humanity's collective IQ continues its death spiral towards non-existence. He posted that with a close-up in January, and that one caught on. Followers came by the thousands. So did the local TV news, and then more followers, and then invites to hang out in the selfie booth at events, and then more followers, and now me, and probably more followers. A flight attendant from Oregon tracked Tucker down during a layover. Another woman supposedly flew from Buffalo just to see him. Tucker probably hates all of this. Kirk said he's not going to try to monetize Tucker's fame. After all, the old man could drop dead at any day now. People just enjoy seeing him, Kirk says. I'm glad that he's able to provide such happiness. If you want to catch Tucker before the Grim Reaper does, your best bet is around lunchtime on Fayetteville Street. Don't let your kids pet without asking. Tucker's been known to nip, though he's missing teeth. But Tucker usually tolerates gentle worship. And don't compare him to a dog. He finds that insulting, Kirk said. Tucker's also cool with selfies. Just don't expect him to smile. Our next news article, Durham for Duffers. New downtown attraction Bull City Mini combines putt-putt fun and Bull City Pride. For golfing fans, certain holes need no introduction. The Landing Pad Island 17th at Swangrass, Sawgrass, for one, or the 11th through the 13th at Augusta National, a.k.a. Amen Corner. With time, perhaps this list will include one of Durham's own, the first hole at Bull City Mini, a wicked little par 2 known as the Can Opener. It's a replica of Durham's low-hanging Gregson Street Bridge, infamous for its propensity to peel the tops off of trucks that try to broach its 11-foot, 8-inch clearance. The putt seems straightforward. Just use the ramp of the truck bed, which ought to deposit your ball close to the hole. Any imprecision, though, and you'll be trolling underneath the railroad overpass and limping toward the 6-stroke maximum. We didn't want to be like what you see at Myrtle Beach, where the course is super kitschy, pirate-themed, says Ben Owens, who co-founded downtown Durham's new mini-golf course with his wife, Julie Bryce. Instead, on the American Tobacco campus, Owens and Bryce created a 7-hole journey through the city's history and lore, complete with inside jokes, puns, and debris from a truck that once found itself outwitted by the bridge. The course also, Owens, is by Durhamites about Durham and really for Durham. The inspiration for Bull City Mini, which opened Saturday, May 11th, came 2 years ago and 1,300 miles away. On the first vacation Owens and Bryce took with their new newborn, they found themselves at Peter Pan Mini Golf Course in Austin, Texas, where Owens had played in his youth. There they experienced the joy of a summer family activity, supplemented with snow cones and a liberal BYOB policy. A native of the Triangle, Bryce vowed to replicate the experience in Durham. The great thing about a crazy idea, she said, is you have the whole drive home to make your point. Through conversations with many golf consultants, yes, they do exist, and community stakeholders, the couple developed a plan for a course soliciting designs for Durham landmarks in miniature and eventually choosing winners from 65 submissions. Owens and Bryce met while he was earning his engineering Ph.D. at UK. He handles operations and data. Bryce is the brains behind the marketing and business development. It's tricky to fit this into or around their day jobs. Owens is a business insights manager. Bryce is a fractional chief marketing officer and parental duties. But Bill City Mini, Bryce said, is the last thing on our lips at night and the first thing we talk about in the morning. 8 days after opening, which falls on National Miniature Golf Day, of course, we hit the links. The indoor-outdoor layout is vibrant. The fourth hole sports the primary colors of the Durham flag. The fifth is bathed in the Eno System Serene Blues. Absent are rubber mats designating where to tee off. Owens or Bryce wanted to allow players flexibility and showcase the sleek aesthetics of the holes. This decision stems from their belief in promoting the work of locals, a fact demonstrated not only by the non-BYOB menu, with its triangle craft beer and local pops and Wonder Puff cotton candy, but also by the back of each scorecard, which highlights the people who made Bull City Mini a reality. Hole designs came from area artists, professionals, school kids, and medical students. Candy Carver painted the silhouetted streetscape mural, and Britt Flood painted the Duke Gardens-themed Forget Me Not. Point Concepts of Raleigh constructed the quaint but challenging holes. I hope that when people come in, they see some part of Durham that they love, and they are reminded why they love living here, says Bryce. Affordability and inclusivity are also paramount. Having spent almost half his life in Durham, Owens wearing a mini golf is for everyone t-shirt says he'll be disappointed if we look up and we've created another thing that's for 20-something yuppies, a valid concern for any venture with a fraise machine. To mitigate that risk, Bull City Mini is focused on offering equitable jobs. They've applied for living wage certification, and they've hired many workers through Step Up Durham. They're also intent on keeping prices reasonable. Mini golf, Bryce said, should be less expensive than a movie ticket. For players 5 and up, a round costs $7. Each hole comes with a placard that provides an opportunity to learn Durham history. Owens and Bryce engaged with Pierce Freelon, a founder of Black Space and former Durham mayoral candidate, to make sure they prioritize the right stories. On the sixth hole, which commemorates the famous shot that Duke's Christian Laettner made to beat Kentucky in 1992, the majority of the text focuses on the 1944 secret game between North Carolina College for Negroes, now North Carolina Central University, and the Duke School of Medicine, one of the South's first recorded racially integrated sporting events. Freelon's point was, ultimately, what's more important than Laettner and Grant Hill had this famous shot, or that the secret game happened and was a crack in the wall of racism in the South? And it happened in Durham, said Bryce. What should we celebrate? Bull City Mini's lease runs through October. If successful, Bryce and Owens want to eventually become Corporate America dropouts and expand operation to 18 or 27 holes. For that to be possible, Bryce said, this needs to be beloved by the community. The creator's enthusiasm is infectious. There are Easter eggs all throughout the course, with new ones already being brainstormed. One in the baseball-themed seventh hole, batter up, a replica hit bull win streak stake sign serves as a backdrop. The design resembles skee ball more than a putting green. Sinking a hole in one requires a Carnival Games confluence of skill and luck. None of us ace it on our first or second attempts. Finally, after half a dozen tries, Owen gets the angles just right and scores the grand prize. Bulls fans might already guess what follows. I won't spoil it. But whether it's a surprise or just a reminder of the city's charm, it's a fitting cap for the passion project. As Bryce put it, this is a love letter to Durham. Our next article, Bridging the Gap. Creating change is an uphill climb. The new Durham nonprofit Upstream wants to make it easier. Upstream Works Collaborative is hard to define. Co-founder Beth Katz describes the goals of her one-year-old nonprofit with terms more befitting a startup aiming to be the most responsive, adaptive, productive, innovative, supportive group possible. The organization's mission statement, working together to support thriving and equitable communities, is almost comically broad. Perhaps the clearest summary comes via negation. I think of Upstream Works as a tool to get things done, says co-founder Julie Katz, Beth's wife. I don't think of it as a volunteer opportunity. Essentially, Upstream empowers individuals to quickly respond to their community's needs through charitable means, facilitated funding for projects, matching specialists with those whose complementary skills, and bridging the gap between the nonprofit's world's false dichotomy of community members and practitioners. The name highlights the organization's belief in going upstream to address the root causes of issues, not solving one-off problems, but finding and eliminating their underlying cause. The 11-person nonprofit featuring specialists in urban design, food equity, affordable housing, transit planning, and more, has already sparked a variety of signature efforts. Durham Bowls, which pairs local chefs with school nutrition managers to build healthier lunches in Durham public schools. Point 4 Health, a tactical urbanism project that improves grocery store accessibility for affordable housing residents in Maplewood and Bull City Rebuilds, which raised nearly $38,000 for those family and businesses affected by the April 10th explosion on Duke Street. The idea began with conversations among co-founders Beth and Julie Katz and Linda Thayer. Betts Katz and Thayer pursue food equity through Ferd Insight Groups, their B Corporation. Julie Katz inhabits the adjacent, if distinct, field of affordable housing. They were facing the same struggles in tackling community problems as the litany of steps required to access grants, engage the right local stakeholders, and even design a website and logo quickly overwhelmed them. The inevitable outcome, says Beth Katz, is not so much shortcoming on project, it's the absence of project. They could have launched separate nonprofits, says Julia Katz, but instead, they build a more versatile solution. With Upstream, potential collaborators apply to join. If accepted, they can apply to develop a project which much fit Upstream's mission, focus on equity, and include interdisciplinary teamwork, or find fiscal sponsorship for grants or tax-deductible donations through Upstream 501c3 status. Much of Upstream's appeal, says Beth Katz, is in creating a structure through which people can do their best work. There isn't a job in everyone's exact perfect spot in their field, says Julia Katz. By fostering discussions among individuals in divergent areas, Upstream enables them to find or build projects that match their passions. Additionally, this often independent work leads to self-selecting, says collaborator and designer Rebecca Meal. The collective structure allows for the sharing of resources, such as accounting and legal services, professional development, or even Adobe access. Meal created the Bull City Rebuilds GoFundMe in the immediate aftermath of the Duke City explosion. Her initiative led to the stirring, slightly terrifying situation of having to equitably disburse thousands of money, but it also led to something more. Less than 2 weeks after the blast, United Way, in conjunction with Upstream and other partners, started the Durham One Fund, which put in place both a standing fund and a system for creating community response teams to help meet needs following future disaster. Meal's success hints at the impacts Upstream might have. Durham Bowls isn't just making tastier school lunches. It's also addressing problematic underfunding and the power of minor tweaks to combat budget shortfalls. Point for Health highlights a neighborhood's food insecurity, but also larger failings around accessibility, like the lack of a city policy requiring affordable housing for seniors to be next to a bus stop. Currently, collaborators aren't paid, and Upstream has no office. But that also means it has less overhead and can be more selective in its projects. And with the startup's flexibility, Upstream can launch ideas faster, as demonstrated by Bull City Rebuilds. Its goal will determine its structure, not vice versa. Upstream's future isn't clear. Its co-founders aren't aiming for exponential growth, although they'll need to grow to sustain their work. But Julia Katz is explaining Point for Health lands on the potential value this collaborative could have. As a member of Durham's Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Commission, she knows that the city wants temporary changes to neighborhoods to demonstrate the desire for crosswalks and bike lanes. Part of Point for Health is the first example of how a community can do it. But there are a lot of hurdles, she said. And so, I'm showing the city, if you want people to do this, it needs to be made easier to do. This is the corollary for Upstream's efforts. Improving equity is nice, but the co-founders know precisely the uphill climb it requires. So together, they're making it a little less difficult. We turn now to the indie food section. Vermouth, misunderstood. The aperitif is more than a mixer for your martini. There's no vermouth in America, exclaims Giancarlo Mancino. Mancino, an artisanal Italian vermouth maker and importer, is leading a spring cocktail class at Apero, a new aperitif bar and restaurant in downtown Raleigh. The late April event had sold out. About 30 professionals had paid $30 to be here, which took Mancino by surprise. Americans has never been big on vermouth, he said. If you want to impress your guests, he continues, stay away from gin and tonic and grab a really good bottle of vermouth, some marjoram and rosemary, and garnish with April flowers. He passes around our first cocktail, a refreshing herbal concoction inspired by a G&T and made of Bianco Ambrato, white vermouth, lavender bitters, yellow rose petals, and twists of lime zest. Mancino has been involved in his family-owned business since he was 7. He learned how to make vermouth from his grandmother. His family fortifies a low-cost table wine from northern Italy and aromatizes it with 40 botanicals. To Mancino, vermouth is more than a family business. It is an essential part of the world in which he grew up, with aperitivos. The word means to open the palate, in the same way that a digestive, like Amaro, closes the palate after a meal. In Italy, he said, communities are drawn together through aperitivo culture, a post-work, pre-dinner socialization ritual centered around snacks and drinks. Americans' inversion to vermouth, Mancino says, goes back decades to when low-quality varieties were used as mixers for martinis. That's how Brittany Dunn, a bartender at the Oak Kitchen and Bourbon Bar, had experienced them. I usually think bitter when I think vermouth, she said. That's how I thought vermouth, too, until years ago when I was in Spain. My companion and I ordered wine at our small hotel bar. A traveler next to us ordered vermouth and was asked if he wanted red or white, with an orange peel or soda water. It was midday, and the drink looked refreshingly enticing. We were curious, so we inquired. Vermouth, we learned, is deeply ingrained in the Catalan culture, a ubiquitous standalone drink. Many bars make their own. I've been hooked ever since. Mancino passed around his version of a martini made with Mancino Sakura vermouth, and a specially bottle infused with cherry blossom extract from Kyoto. He makes 2,500 bottles of Sakura per year. Japan imports 1,000, and a handful of bars and specialty wine shops from London to Oslo to Raleigh get the rest. Sakura's flavor is reminiscent of lychee, but the cherry blossom notes are far superior. It's dangerously easy to drink. As with any vermouth cocktail, chilling is a secret weapon. Mancino says a martini glass should be small so it stays chilled and sips like an espresso. As a recent vermouth convert, I was excited when I learned that Apero had opened in Raleigh earlier this year. Imagine my delight when I discovered that it not only carried vermouth, but it specialized in it. The French have their own vermouth culture, and the French happy hour concept of apéro, co-opened by Will Jeffries of Stanberry and Royale, Jesse Barden, and Jeff Sizer of Royale, and General Manager Nicole Pletcher, features enticing, eclectic small plates that draw on Spanish, French, and Italian influences. Boards of cheese, cured meats, and pâté are the main staples. Pletcher lived in Paris, Brazil, Pakistan, and Connecticut before settling in Raleigh, working at Death and Taxes and the Raleigh Wine Shop, and studying vermouths, sherries, and quinquinas, an aromatized wine traditionally made of Peruvian cinchona bark or Genetian root. She noticed a hole in the city's beverage scene for sherries and fortified wines, but when she opened Apero, she didn't realize that vermouth would become the main attraction. Pletcher introduces patrons to vermouth by introducing the three different styles, dry, typically white, and white and red, which are both sweet. The type you're drawn to depends on the type of liquor you drink. If you're a bourbon drinker, you'll enjoy the richer, sweeter, very savory viscosity of a Rosso. Gin drinkers will go for the botanicals of a Bianco. I don't joke that vermouths are actually pre-batch cocktails, said Fletcher. They're made with sweet elements, bitter elements, and citric elements, and are so cocktails. An added benefit, vermouth cocktails tend to have about a half the alcohol as liquor drinks, which is healthy for a city that runs on cars. And now a section from Upfront. Keep it strong, keep it indie. 23 years ago, the indie gave me a job. It's so much more than that now. According to a UNC study, the U.S. has lost almost 1,800 newspapers in the last 15 years. Earlier this month, the entire staff of the New Orleans, the Times-Picayune, got laid off. In addition, over the last 5 years, several once-dominant alternate weeklies have closed, including The Village Voice and The Boston Phoenix. As a publisher, this isn't reassuring. At the same time, I continue to be blown away by the quality of the journalism that we produce. And as other media outlets scale back, the service our writers and editors provide to the Triangle is more important than ever. That's why I'm asking you to join me in sustaining our journalism to the Indie Press Club. The Press Club is our latest innovation, another way to reinvent, keep in pace with today's reality. If you love and value this publication as much as I do, please visit keepindie.com today to make a one-time or recurring contribution. You can also mail your contribution to Post Office Box 1722, Durham, North Carolina. Soon, we'll match our members with all sorts of benefits, tickets to events, discounts, and retreats, and we'll always repay your support with the finest journalism. Keep it free. Keep it indie. Well, that's about it for another week. This has been Bob Martin for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. And a reminder that this program will be available as a podcast following its initial broadcast. So until next week, goodbye, good night, and good morning.